Have we got the exceptions? They should have already been in our notes from studying. This should not be a novel exercise. Let's talk a little lesson here. If I tell you to pay particular attention to three notes, what should you do? Particular attention to those three notes. Okay, everybody got it done, or do you need a few more minutes? Few more minutes? Okay, a few more minutes. Remember, keep them in the order that they were in the book. Note 4, note 5, note 7. Before class, so that when you study tonight, you can try and fill out a different chart, okay? Did you realize the material got harder than when we were doing intentional torts? And you need to read with more care and think about it. Good? Lesson number one. Okay, what I want to simply check is that you got the nicknames right, and then we'll discuss what you actually put as the rule when we go and do the hypo. So what did you first think the first exception was called? There is a duty to rescue if... imminent peril is okay, but you need something else about the imminent peril. Plaintiff causes the imminent peril. So plaintiff is responsible for or causes the imminent peril. Good. And that's not... Yeah, I'm sorry, what did I flip it? Oh yeah, defendant causes imminent peril to the plaintiff. The plaintiff is in a position of peril caused by the defendant. Good, okay, now I can't bug you, rat. Okay, number two. What did you call that one? Voluntary undertaking. Okay, so there's a voluntary undertaking. Anyone see a nickname? What's the common fact pattern you often see? The defendant has done what? How would you know there's a voluntary undertaking? What has the defendant done? Start to rescue. So you will also see this called the start to rescue rule. In other words, if the defendant voluntarily starts to rescue, they pick up an obligation. Okay, and then number three. What's that? Special relationships. We're about to find out if your relationship is special or not. Excellent. Okay, and we'll talk a little bit more about the content of those three exceptions as we work through the hypos. Okay, anyone really unhappy? Apart from me, because I got it mixed up. Okay, so the first hypos that you see on the sheet are trying to distinguish between misfeasance and nonfeasance. In other words, do you even have a problem with duty, or is this an easy misfeasance case? So if you look at question number one, The defendants live in a high-rise apartment building. They look out their window and witness their neighbor being brutally attacked in the apartment courtyard. The defendants could easily, and at no risk to themselves, pick up the phone and call the police, but they do not. Is there a duty? A, yes, B, no. And you're clicking. No, 21 out of 24. Correct. So would you characterize what the defendants did as misfeasance or nonfeasance? Nonfeasance, right? They failed to rescue. They did nothing, but generally that's okay. Let's try question number two. Anybody who clicked something different want to protest? It's okay, it may be that I got it wrong. That happened just 4 minutes ago. Okay, actually 2 minutes probably. Okay, question two. The defendant construction company worker digs a hole in the street. It's late, so he decides to put the signs and warning lights up first thing in the next morning. Plaintiff arrives early for his torch class and falls in the unlit hole. Plaintiff sue. Defendant argues he does not owe a duty because his failure to put up lights and signs is nonfeasance. Do you think there's a duty? Yes or no? Said yes, but he argued it was nonfeasance. Anyone want to explain to me why they think it's misfeasance?
It would fall under the first exception, would be the defendant put the plaintiff in imminent peril.
So you could argue that you're under an exception. You could say you're not even there at all. So I don't think you even need to go to an exception. So did anyone not go to an exception and instead address the nonfeasance, misfeasance? He says it's nonfeasance, is it? Excellent. And what's the example in the book which is exactly like this? The driver example. Right, I'm driving along, I don't brake, so I kill you. I go, oh, it's nonfeasance. And you say, you say it's misfeasance. Why is it misfeasance? How would you describe my conduct? Would you describe it as failing to brake, or what would you describe it as? Driving dangerously. Everybody see? So don't just focus on the little omission, because often we do, right? Oh, I omitted to look before I changed lane, right? Often your negligence is omission. So don't, just because there's an omission doesn't mean you have nonfeasance. You have to look at the course of conduct, the bundle of conduct, right? And see if you're really alleging nonfeasance or misfeasance. So here there is a duty owed because this is misfeasance. He's digging badly. He's making a construction site badly, right? Everybody see it? So I caught you all, or some of you at least. Okay. Let's look at a case that illustrates the general rule, and then we'll come to the exceptions. So Osterlind is a lovely old case. Well, it's a horrible old case, but it's in most case books. So everybody remember what happens? Anyone notice why the guy may be inebriated? What was the date? It's July 4th, right? It's party time. He's right. They rent a canoe. They go out. It doesn't end happily. 76 to 77. So, what are plaintiff's theory about the defendant, the canoe rental organization? So, plaintiff has some different theories about why they should recover. Anyone want to tell me one of them and why it fails? So, if you were suing the rental, the defendant, the canoe rental, what kind of claims or theories to recover, and why do they fail? Just imagine that your favorite uncle's out there dead.
Yes. His first count, he alleged that the guy who worked at the place, that he had a duty of to the defendant to have a reasonable regard for the safety of the persons to whom he let them go.
Okay, so, and how did he breach that?
The Ryan and the interstate, they were intoxicated, and so he shouldn't have lent the boats to them.
Okay, so that first theory is you had a duty not to rent to people who clearly couldn't manage or adequately control the boats, and the plaintiff intestate was totally intoxicated, so you should never have rented to them. How did they lose that?
They said that since they were intoxicated, there was no contract.
No, that's not how they lose that one.
They were saying that he wasn't helpless because he was able to hang on to the boat and scream, so intoxication was not here.
Bingo! So because he was able to hang on to the boat for 30 minutes and wait for help, he wasn't so incapacitated that it was unreasonable to rant to him. Right, he wasn't like,
I managed the boat, right?
So they say, no, look, he managed to hang on and scream for half an hour, so that shows he wasn't that drunk. A sad but effective argument. Okay, anyone see another argument? Yeah?
Another argument that they levied was that the canoe was flimsy and therefore was unsafe, and the court said that it is the standard condition of canoes to be flimsy.
Right. Well, the court didn't quite say that. They said the description that it was a frail and dangerous canoe seemed to refer not that this canoe was in a particularly worse state of affairs, but that all canoes are kind of liable to tip over and dangerous. Okay, so that one. So they're not able to recover on a wrongful rental theory. See how those two were wrongful? You shouldn't have rented to me because I was blotto. You shouldn't have rented to me because your canoe was lousy. The court says the facts support neither of those claims. So, why is the case in this part of the casebook? What's the final argument they made? Yep.
That the defendant saw the boat capsize and didn't help.
He had a duty to rescue them because for half an hour the guy's on the canoe, allegedly going, I'm drowning, hey! Okay? And what does the court say? The failure of the respondent to respond to the intestate's outcries is immaterial. Why is that immaterial?
They say the plaintiff was able to
establish
himself.
They don't, no, they don't get that far. What do they simply say? There's no duty. You don't have a duty. It's like the people being mugged outside your apartment building. No duty to rescue. So there's a very cruel but vivid illustration of the no duty to rescue. Yep.
So how is this different from the Taco Bell case, where is it only because the guy didn't own the lake, you only owned the means that got them onto the lake?
Okay, so take a step back. So if you wanted to get a different result in this case, what would you have to push the fat pattern into?
You would have had to say there was a special relationship created by him renting them the boat.
Right, so you're going to have to push the case into an exception. Everybody see it? If you want to get a duty here, you're going to push it into an exception. Do you think he owns the lake and they're on his property?
No.
So
landowner one wouldn't work.
Okay.
The rental one isn't enough. He rented them the means to get out there. So he should have some responsibility.
Did you see it in the list?
On the list of
special relations. Special relations. So the answer is no. So the court said you can make an argument that it should go into the special relations, but the court tends to check the list. Do you see what they do? They tend to go, oh, we have a list. Oh, no, you're not special. Right, they check the special relationships. And a renter and a rentee tend not to be a special relationship that triggers the duty for the defendant. Okay? Anyone want to try and get it into another one? I will work for a little bit and see if you can get it into another one. Your good instincts, you're trying to push these cases, you have to acknowledge it's a no duty case, but then you have to try and push it into an exception. Yep?
If they had gotten the fact that the conclusion was flimsy, could they have argued that it was imminent peril caused by the defendant?
He says, I
want to
go for number one. Imminent peril caused by the plaintiff. After all, why is he drowning? Because the defendant gave him a canoe. That raises a question. So what's our problem in that theory? What do you have to show if you're going with exception number one? Yep.
That his actions give direct cause to why he was drowning and that he was not.
So,
like, not that he was acting crazy out of water or something.
So I don't think the note gives you that. Note 4 does not give you that as a limitation. There is a discussion of a limitation in note 4. So, we clearly have a scenario where defendant's actions, defendant's conduct, put plaintiff in imminent peril. So why do you think it might work? Why do you think it might not work? Yep.
Maybe because he knew or should have known that he was going to cause imminent peril.
So does the defendant know or should know he's going to cause imminent peril?
Should know.
You rent a boat to people, what do you think?
Right.
Good. So I don't think it's that. So what about defendant's conduct? How does the book describe a defendant's conduct?
It says when an actor's prior conduct creates a continuing risk. So you can say that when you go further out, like that's where it can be at.
So you don't think when they're out in the water, the duty would apply?
It has a duty of not recklessly operating with you.
Well, that's good. So you'd be arguing that the plaintiff did something wrong, so the plaintiff should be discounted, but you'd still be saying the defendant owes them a duty. So look further down in that note, because there's actually a debate about the description of the defendant's conduct.
Could it be that because he's in the water, that could bring more harm?
So you might say, but then in what case you'd say the defendant did or didn't have a duty? He would have a duty, but it was too dangerous, so he didn't have to do it. But so you're not looking at the text. How does it describe the defendant's conduct? What's the two things the defendant's conduct could be described as? Yep.
You could describe it as reckless for renting it out to two drunk guys.
Okay. The book doesn't use the word reckless. What does it distinguish between? Wrongful versus... Yeah, exactly. Okay, versus lethal. Okay, versus, as she says, innocent, right? So the question is, if you wrongfully cause the plaintiff to be in a position of peril, do you think you have a duty to rescue? Yes. So why doesn't that solve this case? Why didn't he wrongful? Weren't they drunk and the canoe was frail? Right. No, more so, we just decided.
Oh, that.
It wasn't flimsy. Were they so drunk they couldn't control it? No. So, the reason the court, we believe, thinks that exception number one doesn't apply is because the defendant's conduct in renting them the boat may have caused their peril, but he didn't wrongfully engage in conduct. Okay, that would explain this case. Everybody see it? Are we good? Have we written that down before we contradict it? But what does the note say? No, write it down. What's the note say?
They gave the example of the train that through no fault of its own crashes into the truck is still at duty to call for medical assistance for the man who's in the truck.
And if you look at the restatement third's version on the bottom of that page, what does it say?
When an actor's prior conduct, even though not tortuous, creates a continuing risk of physical harm of type characteristic.
Okay, you got past the key bit. What was the key bit?
Even though not tortuous.
Even though not tortious. So the rule seems to say even if you didn't engage in tortious conduct, even if your conduct was innocent or correct, but you put them in imminent peril, you still have a duty to rescue. And that would make the result of this case right or wrong?
Wrong.
Wrong, right? Because even if they innocently or rightfully rented the boat, they still placed him in a position of peril, therefore had a duty to rescue. Awesome, you're absolutely right. You know what the secret is? In 1928, they're still living under the first restatement of torts. And the first restatement of torts says you only have an obligation to rescue if you wrongfully put them in peril. And it's only the second restatement, and indeed the third restatement, that says no, even if you innocently or non-tortiously put them in an obligation, put them in imminent peril, you have a duty to rescue. So the rule changed. So Austerlin today, you could probably push within that exception. Awesome job. Okay, let's do a few more cases to see what exception you think you're going to argue, and then we'll come to Taco Bell. So if you go back to the sheet and look at question number 3, what we're playing is you're going to click 1 if you think exception number 1 works, 2 if you think exception 2 works, 3 if you think exception 3 works, or 4 if you think no exception applies. Everybody see? So let's try picking the right exception. Plaintiff's car stalled in the middle of a country road late at night. Defendant traveling along the same road in her car did not see plaintiff's car in time and ran into plaintiff's car, injuring him. Defendant did not use her cell phone to call for help, and she did not put her coat over P to keep it warm because it was a new coat. She didn't want to get it bloody. Exception. Would you argue exception 1, exception 2, exception 3, or do you think no exception applies? See what you're doing? Oh, I'm ending at 22. There it is. 1 is the best answer. And why is it an easy case? Is it innocent or wrongful conduct? It's wrongful, right? She does not see the car in time and ran into the car, right? So it looks like her wrongful conduct causes the injury, which easily places her in number 1. In fact, even if she'd been driving with all care and hit him, she would still fall within number 1. Any question about number 1? You good? Okay, let's do the next lovely hypo. A helicopter rescue crew locates an injured woman in a dangerous ice gorge. Oh, it could be up that mountain where they're all dying. Did you hear that? That's fine. Don't listen to the news. It's fine. Okay. A helicopter rescue crew locates an injured woman in a dangerous ice gorge. The crew lowers a sling to her and begins to haul it aboard. The sling slips due to the 40 procedure the crew used, and the woman suffers additional injury. Do you think you can get it within an exception? If so, which one? If not, press 4. Number 2. Excellent. Anyone want to argue with me about solving this a different way? You can, actually. Yep. Was it on the list? Check the list. Answer, no. So people often think that police officers have a special relationship, a duty to rescue you. Not true. Because otherwise you could sue them whenever they fail to properly investigate a crime. So there is no duty to rescue or protect that's owed you by officers. Unless they, what exception could you get them under? Start to rescue. Bingo. So that's why it's triggered here. Yes. Not really, because you want to trigger a duty to rescue when? What's happened at the point you want to...
Well, I picked number 2. I just
No, but I'm trying to use you as an awesome educational point. Why are we asking if they have a duty to rescue? What point in her life? Yeah. When she's in the ice forge. So unless they caused her to be in the ice forge, it wouldn't apply. Yep.
But didn't you say they caused her to be like hanging out of the helicopter?
So you could actually characterize the entire conduct as well. I don't know, talk to she. It's misfeasance. So you could actually just say, oh, it's misfeasance, right? They've decided to engage in coercive conduct and they're doing it negligently. So actually the started to rescue cases, you could easily see as misfeasance. It's just they wouldn't have an obligation to even start to rescue. The other interesting thing to realize about the duty to rescue is what you have to pay for. So what would they have to pay for here? If you fail in your duty to rescue, what do you have to pay for? So would they have to pay for her injuries obtained when she originally fell into the gorge? No, right? So all you're paying for is the add-on injuries caused by your failure to rescue. So you don't have to pay for the original injury, you just pay for the add-on injuries caused by your incompetent rescue. Do you have to rescue perfectly?
I actually have a question.
Go ahead.
It says that the faulty procedure the crew used, if there was no faulty procedure and it just happened like a malfunction of the equipment, would that still be in the exception?
Okay, so that's actually the question I was just asking, but you answered it a completely different way, so let's try it. So his thesis is, they go to rescue her, and there's a malfunction in the equipment, even though they properly checked it and all the rest of it, and she tumbles to more agonizing death than before. Okay, so ask two different questions. Question number one, did they owe a duty to rescue? No. Did they owe a duty?
After they commenced rescue.
Yes. Do you think they breached the duty?
No.
Because they?
They did everything right.
They did everything right. So notice, the question is actually two questions in duty. Do you owe a duty? And if so, what duty do you owe? So do you owe a duty to perfectly, safely rescue every time? No. What is that second box on your diagram? Okay? What is, if we say you're within the exception, it's not a duty for a perfect rescue, so what duty is it?
Reasonable care.
Reasonable care is rescuing. So suppose the wind's blowing and there are storms and they can't get her off. Did they breach their duty? No, because they use reasonable care in rescuing. We're never asking that you complete a perfect rescue. We're just saying, hey, make reasonable efforts in the circumstances to try and rescue. Okay? Good. How about question number five? Now we'll go to Taco Bell. Five and six. Question five. Same thing. A physician is on her way to work. She sees an accident and the driver of the car is obviously injured. The doctor continues on her way. Had the driver received prompt medical attention, the injury would have been much less severe. Are we within an exception so the doctor had a duty to rescue? One, two, three, four. There's the 20. Four is the correct answer. There is no duty to rescue. Okay, let's try a new one. Number six. Same question. This time, the physician does stop. In a panic of the moment, however, the doctor moves the driver in a way that is not good medical practice. Is she within an exception? So she decides to stop, she helps, but in a moment of panic, she moves the patient, the driver, in a way that good medical practice does not support. Is she within an exception? One, two, or three? Or four, no duty to rescue? I'm stuck on 18, 19, 20, there it is. Two, correct, because she started to rescue. Okay, you have a client, you're in the car with the doctor. What would you tell her? We're driving past, there's an injured person. What would you tell her? Why? Bingo! It's better not to stop, right? If you keep driving, you have no duty to rescue at all. If you stop and help, you have a duty to rescue with reasonable care. You open yourself up. Everybody see the weird disincentive. Okay, if you were a legislator, what would you do? Do you want people to stop and rescue or not? So what you pass? Good Samaritan statutes. So that's what the Good Samaritan statutes are. They're there to immunize the person who stops and helps. That's why the states went ahead and passed them, because the common law would say, just keep on going. Right? So the Good Samaritan statutes do what? Do they say you're not liable at all, or what do they actually say? You're not liable for negligence. So if you intentionally hurt someone, and in some states, if you recklessly or gross negligence hurt someone, you can still trigger liability. But if you simply negligently help someone, you're immunized by the Good Samaritan statute. Okay? Yep? So by professional, you mean ethical?
Yeah, or like, is there a law that...
No.
Or is it just within their community? Or within
right. Their so even as a lawyer, you have ethical duties, which the laws of ethics impose on you, and you could be subject for discipline by an ethics committee, but it wouldn't be against the law, right? So yes, doctors, having said the Hippocratic Oath, are supposed to solve and help. Right, so it would be... problematic within their ethics, but that's a self-regulated ethical set of laws for their profession. Same for lawyers. And it's not good to violate them. You got a little thing. People Google you and it says, reported 6 ethics violations. Yeah. That would not encourage clients, right? Or other lawyers to deal with you. Okay, are we done? Okay, let's go to Taco Bell. I have to stop there all the time because they have those new, what are they called? Dorito, no, those Dorito taco, whatever they are. What are they called?
Dorito tacos.
Dorito, yeah, I don't know. There's some new. I say it wrong. Believe me, this has been pointed out to me by someone else at my house. I say taco instead of taco, right? That's what Americans say, taco.
You say taco.
Oh, I say taco. Okay, we're going to the restaurant. Okay. So everybody should have found a couple of really familiar things about this case. Like if you look at page 79, you'll see a negligence claim. See that negligence claim? Is it the same definition of negligence that we had? So look at that paragraph number 2. To effectively assert a negligence claim, Baker must establish 1, that Taco Bell had a duty. 2, it failed to conform its conduct. 3, that Baker incurred injuries as a proximate result. Is that the same as our definition? Can you find duty? Which number is duty? What's 2? Breach. Right, failed to conform their conduct is breach. What's 3? Cause and... harm. So they just smush injury and causation into their third element. So as you read cases, every time you should be able to see our 4 elements playing out, even if they describe it slightly differently. You should be able to say, oh, I see injury, duty, breach, causation. Okay, we've already found the general rule, no duty to rescue, right? Even if you know about it. Exceptions. What exception does the plaintiff claim applies here that triggers a duty to rescue? Special relationships. So what do we need? A list. And I found a list of special relationships. Yes.
They put an innkeeper, Professor Glenn, who holds an open to the public for those that enter in response to his invitation, and one who takes voluntarily custody of another under circumstances such as to deprive the other of his normal opportunities for protection.
Okay, and number one is what?
The first one listed was
not innkeeper, there's one ahead of innkeeper. What's the first one?
Common carrier.
Common carrier. What is a common carrier? Just so we know, we can spot these. Mike?
Yep, it's a
plane train on the road. Plane train, not technically on the road. Unless it's a cab, right?
Yeah, that's what
it is. Okay, plane train, taxi, right? Or bus. Okay, that's what a common carrier is. Innkeepers. If you stayed with innkeepers recently, more likely would be
hotels.
Okay. Then the one that we're going to look at here, a landowner to a business invitee. A landowner owes the duty to an invitee. And then it describes those in custodial relationships, right? Did anyone find more special relationships? In the note, right? So what other ones did you find in the note? Yep, Mrs. Lateef? School to student, do I owe you a duty to rescue or protect you? Are you?
No, I'm not.
Right, definitely not. Not college and definitely not law students. I owe no obligation to rescue or protect you. Okay? Yeah, so, right? Okay, so employer, employee, student, school. Hospital patient, anyone spot where those go? Because the we statement doesn't list them, but the we statement means them. So if you were to shove them into the restatement, where do they go? I didn't hear you, so don't.
I thought it was under four.
They are custodial relationships, right? So those are all examples of custodial relationships, right? Prisoner, prisoner, school child, they have a custodial relationship. They can control where they go. So those are actually types of custodial relationships. Okay? Hospital patient, same thing. Okay? How about the special relationship? So everybody does Farwell versus Keaton because it's such an out there case, right? It's a very atypical case. So what was the special relationship in Farwell versus Keaton, 87? Yep. So do you think this is a typical case or an atypical case? Atypical. Why was the court going bound and determined, do you think, to find a special relationship between two drinking buddies?
I just feel like it would set a really bad precedent if they decided to handle those guys owing no duty to his friend because he was engaged in the conduct that caused, well actually no, it wasn't. He didn't engage them, beat him up, but they were both drinking. It's probably a very typical situation of most kids age 15 to 19.
So you think they wanted to create a general rule and that's why, I don't think, so how is this rule atypical? Or what do you think of the conduct of the buddies? You could, if you argued one was an adult, you could actually get custodial. That would be good, but I don't think they went there. How negligent is the buddy? What does he do?
So
you actually solve it as a start to rescue case, right? You gave him eyes, you started to rescue, unfortunately, just decided to leave him in the grandparents' driveway. So you could solve it as a start to rescue case, which is, I think, what most courts would do. I think this court was driven by the evidence about what the guy did. They actually drove around for like 2 hours. He drove through McDonald's while the guy's still in the back of the car going, ah, I'm dying, and going in and out of consciousness. Here, have some fries, right? So it's such an extreme failure to rescue. I think the court pushed the envelope, but it also felt pretty comfortable because it had that start to rescue rationale. Okay, So why is Mr. Baker special to Taco Bell? What's his argument? Which of the special relationships does Mr. Baker have with Taco Bell? Yep.
That it was the possessor of land and holds it open to the public, and he was responding to their invitation.
Right. Was he just someone who wandered in, or what was he doing?
He was coming in to buy a soda.
There you go.
Actually,
so,
he didn't pay for it.
Right. So we have a landowner business invitee. Someone who comes on the land to do business, a business invitee. So they hold there is a duty to rescue. Okay, let's go with his side of the case, and then we'll see what Taco Bell was counter-arguing. If we found a duty, how does he say it was breached? So what's his version of the facts which gets you a breach? Yep.
That the cashier breached the duty to render assistance after it had already been shown.
So he falls down and...
He says that no one even...
No one did anything, right? And you're like, well, that would be a breach of reasonable care. Nobody did anything. Oh, you're on the floor. Next customer, please. Right? That's what they say happened. Now, Taco Bell argues that's not what actually happened, but plaintiff version of the fact is that that's what happened. So we have duty. We have that they failed to then exercise reasonable care and rescue. What kind of damages would he get? So why is he even suing? What kind of damages does he want? From what? So you have to think about the facts. Why is he suing? He says you failed to rescue and my damages are what? Yeah.
For the second round of injuries that happened after that.
Bingo, right? They don't rescue, so he stands up and falls. And at that point, he gets the really serious injuries, right? He loses his teeth, he cracks his neck. So he's saying your failure to rescue me led to that exacerbated set of injuries, and that's what I'm suing for. Everybody see? That's what your failure to rescue claim is. Let's look at Taco Bell's argument. So Taco Bell has some silly arguments, some policy ones, and some legal ones. Right? Because the court said whether there's a duty is a question of the relationship, foreseeability, and policy. So you want to do, let's do the legal ones first, because I know you'll stay late just to do the policy ones, mm-hmm. but you'll want. So when does Taco Bell say the duty to rescue is triggered? What's the argument they're making that if you look at the precedent, there is no duty to rescue? What do they say you have to show? Yep.
When the injury was caused by something in their control, like under their premise.
But wasn't he an invitee?
Right. I mean, like, it's caused by something that in the restaurant itself, not by just natural causes.
So that the restaurant itself has to cause the injury. And where do they come up with that? The little boy on the escalator case, right? Because what had the court said in the escalator case? The boy was both a, yep.
Oh, I was going to say that. It was due to the instrument's hand.
And the boy was? Invitee. So if you look at the quote that they pull out of Ayers, right? Which is 180. See that big indented quote? I'm sorry, 80. See page 80? Big indented quote. And then here's Taco Bell's argument. The court in the Ayers case noted that the boy was an invitee and he received his initial injury using the instrumentality in the defendant's control. Everybody see what their argument is? How's that different from what the restatement says, or what the exceptions we've been looking at? So how's that different from the exceptions we've been working with? Haven't we said that an exception is? And haven't we said that an exception is special relationship? So why is their argument, right there, different from ours? Because surely we've recognized those exceptions. Causing the injury, and an invitee. Yep.
Because they said it has to be both, and we said it can be one or the other.
Bingo. Excellent. Everybody see? They're saying you have to tick both the special relationship and the cause box to have a duty to rescue. And we've said, no, either box is enough. And what does the court say? Both boxes, or it's enough if you have a special relationship. Right, it's enough that he's an invitee. You don't have to show he caused it. Okay, policy-wise, what does Taco Bell argue? Okay?
They said that one of the things that was specifically mentioned was to provide first aid if it's available. And Taco Bell said, well, that's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. You're now going to require every Taco Bell and every fast food place to have someone on hand who knows first aid in the event that something bad should happen, and then we're going to be responsible for rescuing them. But we're not medical professionals, and you're asking us to become a hospital.
Right. And right. Then you've been, I represent Taco Bell. Hey, we are these 16-year-olds. They can barely make tacos. And you want to tell them to rescue people? Really? Really? You want to say they should run out and stop helping these people? Doing CPR? That your drink's wrong. Like, really? Come on. I think this is a great argument. So why does the court shoot it down? Yes.
Because they're saying they're not requiring them to administer, like, exceptional care. They just need to do something within a reasonable amount in circumstances.
Bingo. So the first thing they shoot down is we're just saying use reasonable care. And when you look at common F that's at the top of 82, what does reasonable care require the little dudes to do? The taco dudes. Call an ambulance, right? You can render first aid or you can simply call other people, right? Right? They'd be required to do more than give such first aid as they reasonably can and take reasonable steps to turn the person over to the physician. Right? It's not saying you have to be trained in CPR and be a great medical professional. Right? It just says first aid that you can reasonably do, like put a napkin over the bleeding and call 911. And even the Taco Bell dudes can do that. Yep.
The other thing that they said was it would be ridiculous to have the workers try to determine, okay, did this person have a seizure and fall over, or did they slip on some of our ice? Because if they have a seizure, we just leave them there. But if they tripped on our ice, then we have to take care of them.
And why would it matter, according to Taco Bell, if they were choking on a Taco Bell piece of food or a piece of gum they were chewing when they came in? Bingo, because under Taco Bell rule, you'd only have to pick them off if your instrumentality was choking them, right? So under the Taco Bell theory, you'd open their mouth and go, oh, no, it's a burger, bye. Right? Oh, no, it's nachos! I'm the rescue. Now, like, really? You think you should train your employees to do that?
So, I mean, it's clear to me that he was a business employee because he actually, well, initiated a purchase, but if he had just come in to, like, use the restroom, he'd still be considered a business employee.
Oh, you're such an awesome segue. Read for tomorrow and find out.